Chetty Singh stood at the observation window as his wife came into the office. She saw instantly that he was disturbed. He was plucking thoughtfully at his beard and his eyes were slitted. "That white man," he nodded towards the store floor below the window, "did you notice him?" "Yes," she came to his side. "I noticed him as he came in. I thought he might be a soldier or a policeman."
"And what made you think that?" Chetty Singh demanded.
She made an eloquent gesture with those lovely hands that were so incongruous on a female of her bulk. They were the hands of the young girl he had married almost 30 years ago, and the pale palms were dyed with henna. "He stands tall and walks with pride," she explained, "like a soldier."
"I think I know him," Chetty Singh said. "I saw him very recently, but it was at night, and I cannot be absolutely certain."
He picked up the telephone from his desk and dialed 2 digits. Standing at the window, he watched his second daughter pick up the telephone from beside her cash register.
"Treasure," he spoke in Hindi, "the man at your till, is he paying with a credit card?"
Yes, father."
She was the brightest of all his children. As much value to him as the second son, almost.
"Get his name and ask him where he is staying in town."
Chetty Singh hung up and watched the white man pay for his purchases and leave the store heavily laden. As soon as he had gone, Chetty Singh dialed again.
"His name is Armstrong," his daughter told him. "D.A. Armstrong, he says that he is staying at the Capital Hotel."
"Good. Let me speak to Chawa quickly."
Below him, his daughter swiveled her seat and called one of the uniformed security guards from the main doors. She held out the telephone receiver to him, and as he placed it to his ear, Chetty Singh asked,
"Chawa, did you recognize the Malungu who has just left? The tall one with thick curly hair?"
Chetty had switched to Angoni.
"I saw him," the guard replied in the same language, "but I did not recognize him."
4 nights ago, Chetty Singh prompted him, "on the road near Chirundu, just after we had loaded the truck. The one who stopped and spoke to us."
There was silence as Chawa considered the question. Chetty Singh saw him begin to pick at a nostril with his forefinger, a sign of uncertainty and embarrassment.
Perhaps, Chawa said at last, "but I am not sure."
He removed the thick forefinger from his nose and inspected it minutely. He was a man of the Angoni, a distant relative of the royal line of Zulu. His tribe had migrated this far north 200 years ago at the time of King Shaka. He was a warrior and not a man given to deep thought.
"Follow him," Chetty Singh ordered. "Do not let him see you. Do you understand?"
"I understand, Inkosi."
Chawa looked relieved to be ordered into action, and he left through the main doors with a spring in his step. He returned 30 minutes later, hangdog and crestfallen. As soon as he came in through the main doors, Chetty Singh telephoned his daughter again.
"Send Chawa up to my office right away."
Chawa stood in the doorway at the head of the stairs, as big as a gorilla, and Chetty Singh demanded,
"Well, did you follow him as I ordered?"
"Nkosi, it is this same man."
Chawa shuffled his feet. Despite his size and strength, he was terrified of Chetty Singh. He had seen what happened to those who displeased the master. In fact, it was Chawa himself who was usually responsible for enforcing his master's discipline. He did not look directly into his eyes as he went on.
"It is the man who spoke to us on the night," he said, and Chetty Singh frowned quickly.
"Why are you sure now, when you were uncertain before?"
Chetty Singh demanded.
"In the truck,"
Chawa explained. "He went to his truck and put the goods he had bought from us into it. It is the same truck, with a man's arm painted on the side, Mambo."
"Good,"
Chetty Singh nodded approval. "You did well.
Where is the man now?"
"He drove away in the truck."
Chawa looked apologetic. "I could not follow him. I am sorry, Nkosi Kukulu."
"Never mind. You did well," Chetty Singh repeated. "Who is on duty at the warehouse tonight?"
"I am, Mambo."
Chawa grinned suddenly. His teeth were large and even and very white.
"And, of course, Nandi."
"Yes, of course," Chetty Singh stood up. "I will come to the warehouse this evening after business is closed. I want to make sure that Nandi is ready to do her job. I think we may have trouble tonight. I want everything prepared. Have Nandi in the small cage. I don't want any mistakes. Do you understand, Chawa?"
"I understand, Mambo."
"At 6 o'clock, at the warehouse."
Sometimes it was as well to repeat instructions to Chawa.
"Nkosi."
Chawa sidled from the room, still not looking directly at his master. After he had gone, Chetty Singh sat staring at the closed door for many minutes before he picked up the telephone again. Direct dialing to an international exchange was always a lottery in Africa. Zimbabwe was almost a neighbouring state. Only the narrow Tet corridor of Mozambique separated them. Nevertheless, it took him a dozen attempts and 20 frustrating minutes before he heard a ringing tone at the other end of the line and was through to the number in Harare.
"Good afternoon. This is the Embassy of the Republic of Taiwan. May I help you?"
"I wish speech with the ambassador."
"I'm sorry. His Excellency is not available at present. May I take a message or put you through to another member of the staff?"
"I am Chetty Singh. We are abundantly acquainted."
"Please hold on, sir."
A minute later, Cheng came on the line.
"You are not to telephone me at this number. We agreed."
Chetty Singh told him firmly.
"This is urgent, absolutely. I cannot speak on this line. I will call you back within an hour. Give me your number there and wait for me."
The private unlisted telephone on Chetty Singh's desk rang 40 minutes later.
"This line is secure," Cheng told him as he picked it up. "But be discreet." "Do you know a white chap named Armstrong?"
"Dr. Armstrong, yes, I know him."
"This is the one you met at Chiwewe and who accosted you on the road regarding certain stains on your clothing, is it not?"
"Yes,"
Cheng's tone was noncommittal.
"It's all right, don't worry, he knows nothing."
"Then why has he pitched up at Lilongwe?"
Chetty Singh demanded.
"You still want me not to worry?"
There was a silence.
"Lilongwe,"
Cheng said at last.
"Did he also see you that night on the Chiwundu Road?"
"Yes," Chetty Singh tugged at his beard.
"He stopped and spoke to me. He asked if I had seen the park's trucks."
"When was that? After we had transferred the ivory to you?"
"Careful," Chetty Singh snapped. "But yes, it was after we had parted our different separate ways. Never mind. My men and I were tying down the tarpaulins when this white chap in a truck pulled up,"
Cheng cut in.
"How long did you speak to him?"
"Oh, a minute. No more than that. Then he went south towards Harare. I think he was following you, without a morsel of doubt."
"He caught up with Gomo and forced him off the road."
Cheng's voice was sharp and agitated.
"He searched the park's trucks, and of course he did not find anything."
"He is suspicious indubitably."
"Indubitably,"
Cheng agreed sarcastically.
"But if he spoke to you for only a minute, he cannot connect you. He doesn't even know who you are."
"My name and address are boldly imprinted upon my truck,"
Chetty Singh said. Cheng was silent again for a slow count of five.
"I did not notice. That was imprudent, my friend. You should have covered it."
"It's no good closing the stable door after the bird has flown," Chetty Singh pointed out.
"Where is the..."
Cheng broke off.
"Where are your goods? Have you shipped them?"
"Not yet. They will go out tomorrow."
"Can't you get rid of them sooner?"
"That is beyond the bounds of possibility."
"You will have to deal with Armstrong, then, if he becomes too curious."
"Yes," said Chetty Singh, "I will deal with him most firmly and resolutely. Your side? Is everything taken care of? Your Mercedes?"
"Yes."
"The two drivers?"
"Yes."
"Have the authorities visited you?"
"Yes, but it was routine,"
Cheng assured him.
"There were no surprises. They have not mentioned your name to me. But you must not telephone me again in the embassy. Use this number only. My security people have cleared this line."
He gave Chetty Singh the number, and he wrote it down carefully.
"I will let you know about this chap. He is an absolute nuisance," Chetty Singh went on.
"I hope not for too much longer."
Cheng cradled the receiver and instinctively reached for one of the assembly of ivory netsuka that were arranged on his desktop. It was an exquisite miniature carving of a young girl and an old man. The beautiful child sat on the old man's lap, staring with a daughter's adoration into his noble, lined and bearded face. Each tiny detail had been executed 300 years ago by one of the great artists of the Tokugawa dynasty. The ivory had been polished by the touch of human fingers until it glowed like amber. Only when the group was inverted was it disclosed that beneath their flowing robes the couple were naked, and that the old man's member was buried almost to the hilt between the girl's thighs. The humour of it appealed to Cheng. It was one of his favourite pieces from all his vast collection, and he caressed it now between thumb and forefinger like a worry bead. As always, the silken feel of the ivory soothed him and encouraged him to think more clearly. He had been expecting to hear more of Daniel Armstrong, but this had not lessened the shock of Chetty Singh's message. The Sikh's questions aroused old doubts, and for the thousandth time he went over all the precautions that he had taken. After leaving the headquarters camp at Chiwewe, he had not noticed the blood on his shoes and clothing until Daniel Armstrong had drawn his attention to it. This evidence of his guilt had preyed on his mind for the rest of that arduous journey out of the Zambezi Valley. When at last they reached the main highway and found Chetty Singh waiting at the rendezvous, he had confided his worries to the Sikh and showed him the stains on his clothing. "You were not supposed to go near the scene of the killing. That was foolish, never mind. I had to make sure a job was done, and it was just as well I did. The warden was still alive. You will have to burn that clothing." It was unlikely that there would be other traffic this late at night, but they took no chances. They reversed the trucks well off the highway and transferred the ivory from the park's trucks to Chetty Singh's pantechnicon behind a screen of trees. Even with Chetty Singh's gang of men to assist the two drivers, the removal took almost 2 hours. It was a huge quantity of ivory to move. In the meantime, Chetty Singh watched Cheng build a small fire. When it was burning hotly, the ambassador stripped to his underwear. As he dressed again in fresh clothing from his luggage, Chetty Singh squatted beside the fire and burned all the soiled items. The rubber soles of the training shoes flared up fiercely when they caught. He used a stick to poke the charred scraps into the centre of the flames and make certain that they were reduced to fine ash. "There will still be abundant traces of blood in the Mercedes," Chetty pointed out as he stood up from the fire. "On the floor, on the accelerator and brake pedals." He removed the floor mat and the rubber covers from the control pedals and burned these as well. The stink of the black smoke made his eyes run, but still he was not satisfied. "We will have to get rid of that car," he told Cheng what to do. "I will arrange the rest of it." Cheng was the first to leave the rendezvous. Even before the transfer of the ivory to the Sikh's truck was complete, he was on his way back to Harare. He drove fast, as though trying to escape from his involvement with the raid. The reaction was setting in now. It was the same after one of his sexual pantomimes in the Myrtle Blossom Lady's house in Taipei. Afterwards he felt shaky and nauseated. He always promised himself it would never happen again. The ambassador's residence was one of many large, sprawling colonial buildings in the avenues near the golf club. He reached it well after midnight. He went directly to his own bedroom suite. He had arranged for his wife and the children to fly back to Taiwan the previous week to stay with her family. He was alone in the residence. He stripped once again, and even though he had not worn it at the scene, placed all his clothing in a plastic bag. He was concerned that the faintest trace of blood might linger upon it. Then he showered. He stood under the steaming spray for almost half an hour, shampooing his hair twice and scrubbing his hands and fingernails with a stiff brush. When he felt that he had washed away every last trace of blood or gunpowder, he dressed in fresh clothing from his dressing room and carried the plastic bag containing his clothing back to the Mercedes parked in the residence garage. He placed the plastic bag in the boot beside his canvas grip. He was anxious to get rid of every single item that he had taken to Chiwewe, even his binoculars and his bird book. He reversed the Mercedes out of the garage and parked it in the front driveway of the residence. The gates were open, and he left the key in the ignition. Although it was by now after 2 in the morning, and it had been a day and night filled with activity and intense nervous strain, Cheng could not sleep. In a brocaded silk robe, he paced the bedroom restlessly until he heard the starter of the Mercedes whirl. He switched off the bedside lamp and darted to the window overlooking the front driveway. He was just in time to see his car, with darkened headlights, pull out of the driveway and turn into the deserted street. He sighed with relief and at last went to bed. As he composed himself to sleep, he thought how swiftly Chetty Singh had arranged it. Chetty Singh's son managed the Harare branch of the family interests. He was almost as astute and reliable as his father. In the morning, after breakfast, Cheng telephoned the police and reported the theft of the Mercedes. They found it 24 hours later, out near Hatfield, on the way to the airport. It had been stripped of tyres and engine and set on fire. The fuel tank had exploded, and nothing was left of the vehicle but the soot-blackened carapace. He knew that the insurance company would pay out in full, without too much delay or protest. The following morning, an anonymous caller on Cheng's unlisted line spoke without introduction or explanation. "Look at page 5 of today's Herald," he said, then broke the connection. But the accent had been Asian, very similar to Chetty Singh's manner of speech. Cheng found the article at the foot of the page. It was 6 lines under an insignificant heading, "Stabbed in Drunken Brawl." Gomo Chisonda, a ranger employed by the National Park Service, had been stabbed to death by an unknown assailant during an argument in a township beer hall. The next day, the same anonymous caller told Cheng, page 7. This time, Cheng was certain that he recognized the voice of Chetty Singh's son. The heading of the newspaper article was "Railway Accident," and the squib read, "The body of David Shiri, an off-duty ranger in the National Park Service, was found on the railway line near Hartley. The dead man had a high blood alcohol level. A spokesman for Zimbabwe Railways warned the public of the danger of using unguarded crossings. This is the 4th accident of the same kind on the Hartley line since the beginning of the year." As Chetty Singh had promised, there were no longer any surviving witnesses or accomplices. 3 days later, Cheng received a telephone call from the Commissioner of Police in person. "I am very sorry to disturb you, Your Excellency. I presume you have read about the murderous attack on Chiwewe camp. I believe that you may be able to assist our inquiries into this most unfortunate incident. I understand that you are a visitor at the camp on that day, and that you left only hours before the attack."
"That is correct, Commissioner."
"Would you have any objection to making a statement to assist us? You know that there is no obligation for you to do so. You are fully protected by diplomatic privilege."
"I will cooperate with you in any way possible. I particularly admired and liked the warden who was murdered. I would do all I can to help you apprehend the perpetrators of this foul crime."
"I am most grateful to you, Your Excellency. May I send one of my senior inspectors to call upon you?"
The inspector was a burly shoner in plain clothes. He was accompanied by a sergeant in the smart uniform of the Zimbabwean police, and both of them were elaborately obsequious. With profuse apologies, the inspector took Cheng through a recital of his visit to Chiwewe, including his departure with the convoy of refrigerator trucks. Cheng had rehearsed all this, and he went through it faultlessly. He was careful to mention his meeting with Daniel Armstrong. When he had finished, the inspector fidgeted uncomfortably before asking,
Dr. Armstrong has also made a statement, Your Excellency. His account confirms everything you have told me, except that he mentioned that he noticed there were bloodstains on your clothing."
When was that?" Cheng looked puzzled.
"When he encountered you and the park's trucks, as he was returning to Chiwewe, after having seen the tracks of the raiders on the road." Cheng's expression cleared.
"Ah, yes, I have been an interested spectator of the park's elephant culling. As you can imagine, there was much blood about during the operation. I could easily have stepped in a puddle."
The inspector was sweating with embarrassment by this stage.
"Do you remember what you were wearing that evening, Your Excellency?"
Cheng frowned as he tried to remember.
"I was wearing an open-neck shirt, blue cotton slacks, and probably a pair of comfortable running shoes. That is my usual casual attire."
"Do you still have those items?"
"Yes, of course. The shirt and slacks were being laundered by now, and the shoes were being cleaned. My valet is very efficient."
He broke off and smiled as though a thought had only just occurred to him.
"Inspector, do you want to see these items? You might even wish to take him away for examination."
Now the police inspector's embarrassment was painful. He squirmed in his chair.
We have no right to ask for that kind of cooperation, Your Excellency. However, in view of the statement made by Dr. Armstrong, I really would be grateful, and if you had no objection."
"Of course not," Cheng smiled reassuringly.
"I told the Commissioner of Police I want to cooperate in every possible way."
He glanced at his wristwatch.
"However, I am due at lunch with the President at State House in an hour. Do you mind if I send the clothing down to your headquarters where a member of my staff?"
Both police officers sprang to their feet.
"I am very sorry to have inconvenienced you, Your Excellency. We appreciate your help. I am sure the Commissioner of Police will be writing to you to tell you that himself."
Without rising from his desk, Cheng stopped the inspector at the door. "There was a report in the Herald that the raiders had been apprehended," he asked. "Is that correct? Were you able to recover the stolen ivory?"
"Their bandits were intercepted at the Zambezi as they tried to cross back into Zambia. Unfortunately, all of them were either killed or escaped, and the ivory was destroyed by fire or lost in the river."
"Why a pity," Cheng sighed.
"They should have been made to answer for these brutal killings. However, it has simplified your work, has it not?"
"We are closing the file," the inspector agreed. "Now that you have helped us tidy up the loose ends, the commissioner will write to convey his appreciation, and that will be the end of the matter."
The packet of clothing that Cheng selected from his wardrobe and sent to police headquarters, although agreeing with the description he had given the inspector, had never been worn anywhere near Chiwewe or the Zambezi Valley. Cheng sighed now as he thought about it. He replaced the ivory netsuke on his desk and stared at it morosely. But it was not the end of the matter, not now that Dr. Daniel Armstrong was nosing around, making trouble. Could he rely on Chetty Singh once again, he wondered? It was one thing to get rid of two lowly parks rangers, but Armstrong was game of a larger kind. He had an international reputation and fame. There would be questions if he disappeared. He touched the intercom button and spoke into the microphone on his desk in Cantonese.
"Lee, come in here, please."